Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 54, Text Number 47. Janmadayastu dehasya Vikriya natmana kuchit Kalanam eva naivindo Mritti hasya kuhuriva Janmadayastu dehasya Vikriya natmana kuchit Kalanam eva nevando Mritte hasya kuhuriva Janmadaya sudehasya Vikriya natmanaha kachit Kalanam eva nevando Ditya Hasya Kuhuriva Janma Adhaya. Birth and so on. Two. But Dehasya of the body. Vikriya. Transformations. Na. Not. Atmana. Of the self. Pachit. Ever. Kalanam. Of the phases, eva, as, na, not, eva, indeed, indo, of the moon, mritya, the death, he, indeed, asya, of it, kuhu, the new moon day, eva, as. Translation. Birth and other transformations are undergone by the body but never by the self. Just as change occurs for the moon's phases but never for the moon. Though the new moon day may be called the moon's death. Purport. Lord Balaram here explains how the conditioned souls identify with the body and how this identification should be given up. Certainly every ordinary person considers himself or herself young, middle-aged or old, healthy or sick, but such identification is an illusion. When we identify ourselves with the material body, we lose our power to understand the soul. So this verse, another very wonderful verse spoken by Lord Balaram. Here, the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, from his very lotus lips, is speaking. So we can take this, these words of Lord Balaram as very wonderful, very sacred. So, to put this verse, of course, into context, we can just quickly sum up what Lord Balaram has been saying. So, question time. Who's Lord Balaram speaking to? Rukmini, yes. And why is Balaram speaking to Rukmini?
To pacify her.
To pacify her, yes. Because Rukmi, her brother, had been disfigured and had been given a very peculiar and odd haircut by Lord Krishna, and Rukmini intervened to save her elder brother from further punishment. So Rukmini had actually seen that Krishna wasn't going to forgive Rukmi. At this particular point, she manifested symptoms of great fearfulness, and she began to tremble. Her voice choked up, and her hair loosened, the different bangles and what have you fell from her wrists, and she fell to the ground and pleaded at Krishna's lotus feet. So Lord Balaram, of course, seeing the very anxiety-ridden state of Rukmini, spoke these words, these moral and ethical and philosophical instructions, which we are almost at the end of. So, first of all, Balaram explained, in order to encourage Rukmini, he first gave Krishna, a little rebuking. Oh, Krishna, you should not have done this to, Rukmi. He's your brother-in-law, and Rukmi's elder brother. Rukmini's elder brother. just in order to be. In order to be fair. Actually, Balaram's instructions, though, were more directed towards Rukmini. And sometimes he spoke to Krishna as if admonishing Krishna. But then gradually, it's revealed that the real instruction is going to Rukmini. And ultimately, Balaram describes it. Some moral principles that a relative is, they shouldn't kill another relative. And then he gives a higher principle. But in times of war, and especially with Kshatriyas, then, that rule is overridden. And, one brother can kill another brother. And therefore there's no fault. And especially in the case with someone like Rukmi, who had, acted, he was ready to kill Krishna, and he was ready to do anything, any terrible deed, in order to get his way. Lord Balaram actually said to Rukmini that it was unfair of her to actually, take the side of Rukmi, who was obviously behaving, as a complete rascal who deserves severe punishment. And Krishna just gives him a light slap on the wrist, and Krishna is actually in the right. It was a little unfair. So he explained that when one is covered by Maya, that then sometimes, then ordinary people who don't have proper knowledge because of illusion, they identify themselves with the body and their relatives, those, other bodies that are related to their body as their relatives, and they act in all sorts of different ways according to this illusory bodily identification. And Lord Balaram was suggesting that a person of Rukmini's knowledge certainly should not act in that way. Therefore, Lord Balaram further explained that point, that the real knowledge, that's the illusion, to accept the body as the self, and relationships relative to the body as all in all. So Balaram explained that the body is not the self. The body is not the soul. The body is not the soul, and the body is not the super soul. So he explained this in different verses, previous verse, and he gave the example of the sun. By seeing the activities of the sun, we can therefore understand how the soul never really, although it produces the body, it is the cause of manifesting the body, let's put it that way, still the soul doesn't really come into contact with the manifestation of the body or separate from it. And in the same way, the sun, we see the sun rises and sets. When the sun rises, it creates all sorts of manifestations, and then the sun just leaves. And it sets, and it has nothing to do with, everything it has created. And then it, rises again, more creation, and then it just leaves. And just leaves behind what it has created. In the same way, according to the soul, we manifest this particular body, and then when the soul leaves this body, it just has nothing to do with it at all. It just goes into another body. In the same way, we're in this body now, we don't care, really about our last body. And all the relatives, that were there, we had mothers, fathers, cousins, brothers, we don't ever think about them. In the previous life, they were, that illusory reality was manifest as a result of the desires and karma of the soul. So, in this particular verse, Balaram is explaining again this point, giving the example of the moon. That I'll read the translation. That birth and other transformations are undergone by the body, but never by the self. Just as change occurs for the moon's phases, but never for the moon. Though the new moon day may be called the moon's death. So here another very, very good example. So first, Lord Balaram has used the example of the sun, and now he's using the example of the moon. And we see that in the Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna says that among lights I am the sun and the moon, etc., etc. Some particular manifestations within the material world, because of they are reflections of the original characteristics of the Supreme Lord, we can then sometimes get a glimpse of the nature of the Supreme Lord by looking at those reflections within this material world. So by looking at the sun and the moon, which are representations of the Lord within the material world, we get a little bit of an idea of, the nature of spirit, the Supreme Spirit, like this. So here is given the example of the moon. We see when the moon appears to take birth, it gradually waxes and then becomes the full moon, and then it appears to grow old and die. So it begins to wane down to almost nothing like that. So, but factually, although that's what it looks like, the moon is neither growing nor waning. That's just what it looks like for us, but the moon is actually just fixed in its own constant, radiant glory. So things are not what they seem. That's a very nice example. In the same way, the body goes through these changes, and therefore people in illusion, they think that the self is going through those changes. But the self, which is actually the spirit soul, does not go through those changes. So there are many different philosophies, just like some within the Christian religion believe that when you take birth, the soul is actually born at that time. And they have a conception that the body at the time of resurrection is recomposed, being blessed by the Lord, takes on a spiritual nature and ascends to heaven, which is, you know, an unusual concept. You sort of, you know, when you think about that, because, you know, the molecules and parts of this body have obviously, you know, been eaten by various other bodies and what have you. So then parts of our bodies are actually in other bodies. So then, you know, to sort of regather, recoup, it doesn't make sense. But you see, when that's because they're seeing the self in the same way that someone would see the phases of the moon, and they're associating the self with those changes. Right? But to actually understand the self, you cannot associate the changes of the body as relating to the self. And that's the example of the moon. At the same time, the changes of the moon do have an effect, but not to the moon. Right, so for instance, when the moon is waxing, is a very good time to begin something, or people plant vegetables, certain seeds are sown when it is waxing, certain things are sown when it's waning. Generally, auspicious deeds are done during the bright fortnight, especially with the waxing moon. The bright fortnight has two parts. In the first part, the moon begins to wax from the new moon, and then in the second week, it begins to be fully. That's actually called the paksha, the gora paksha, right? The bright part of the moon. But actually, that second week and the first week of it waning are really the bright part of the moon. That's the bright fortnight. See? Because at that stage the moon is between half and full. Even in that second week where it's waning, it's going from full to half. And the dark moon is considered really from, starts from the second week of the waning moon and goes into the first week of the waxing moon. So you've got bright and dark. Sometimes there's a little confusion there. So you have Gaura Paksha, where the moon is actually waxing, and you have Krishna Paksha, where the moon is waning. But the bright fortnight is actually half of both of those, and the dark fortnight is half of both of those, you understand? So certain things are done in the bright fortnight, and certain things are done in the dark fortnight. You know, generally the thieves and rogues get out in the dark fortnight. You know, it's considered inauspicious. You know, there are certain things you don't do because it's dangerous. It's dangerous because a lot of, inauspicious, ghosts and, living beings like that, plus, thieves and robbers, they all get out during the dark moon because, it's very hard. You can't see them, and they get up to mischief at night time. They get out there. During the bright fortnight, it's very difficult for people to be mischievous at night time because it's very easy to see them sneaking around the houses and what have you. and then, of course, so, different thing. The moon has different effects. there are different things done during the different tithis. You know, there are 15 days. You've got Pratipat, you know, Dvitiya, Tritiya, Chaturthi, Panchami, Shasti, Saptami, Astami, Navami, Dasami, Kodasi, Dvadasi, Triadasi, Chaturdasi, and Purnima. And then it starts again. So you get two lots of those within the full month. And on each one of those, the moon has a different effect, so you would be doing different things. Right? So when it's the Dasami, the 10th day of the moon, very good for doing auspicious works. And as we know, the Ekadasi, the 11th day, is very good for, you know, devotional activities and sadhana. You know, one enters one's fort on the Navami, Ram Navami. One causes great harm on the Chaturthi and Chaturdasi. We have Nisringa Chaturdasi. He caused great harm to. That's when you kill your enemies. So the you know, the different phases of the moon, they affect us in different ways. If you look at the different wars, it's always interesting. I always take note of when different wars begin, and they usually begin on certain days. And you know, in recent history, I know that they plan to start wars like the Gulf War, this and that. They plan their attack, you know, on certain, you know, phases of the moon, dark or bright phase, and also, you know, on certain tithis. Of course, they have no idea of the tithis, but it's interesting that, you know, generally these days are particularly good. Some days are particularly good for harassing other people, and if you look, you know, on those days, it's you'll see that people, you know, like I always notice that people who have that bent of mind, they seem to be quite active on those days. So, you know, the different the moon's phases, it has different effects, but not on the moon. You know, so although we say the moon's phases are apparent, that, you know, the different changes in the moon, which are in relationship to the moon and its changing position with the earth and the sun, and there are different effects, but those effects are not for the moon, they're for us, you know, here on earth. So similarly, you know, the soul, in association with the changing modes of material nature, the changing modes of material nature do create an effect, but not for the soul. And therefore, you know, you have long-term effects of creation, maintenance and destruction of the body, according to the various modes, and then you have your day-to-day sort of activities. So by looking at this, we can very nicely see the situation of the soul, that it is transcendental to the changes that are taking place, including birth, death, old age and disease within the body. So it's a very nice example there. So things are not always what they seem, though. You know, if we're just looking at something, unless it's pointed out, unless transcendental knowledge is pointed out to us, it's very easy to, you know, misunderstand what we are seeing. So, you know, this is the wonderful opportunity we have with the Supreme Lord Himself. And no one knows better what, you know, how to look at things than the Lord Himself, and He's saying, you know, this is how you should look at it. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, He has given us this Sankirtan movement, which is the benediction moon. And by the benediction rays from the holy name, we are able to see things properly. Therefore, we have that Shastika, you know, Chaitadapanam, Majanam, Bhava Mahadavagni Navapanam, Shekharavachandrikavatthadanam vijavarujivanam anandam buddhivadanam pradipuranam pradanam vitasvadanam sarvapnasnapanam param vijayate Shri Krishna Sankirtan. In this verse, Lord Chaitanya, although Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he instructed his disciples to write volumes, you know, voluminous works on how to see the nature of the soul, the supreme soul, you know, time, material energy, like that. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, he compressed all of those teachings into 8 verses. Very expert. And in the first verse, he describes the glories of the holy name of the Lord. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to recite this Shishastikam regularly, this you know, various prayers from the Shishastikam, and he would recite a particular prayer from the Shishastikam, and then many different prayers from Srimad Bhagavatam and various Puranas and what have you, to, you know, substantiate and to you know, foster that mood that is there within those Shishastikam prayers. And he used to, in the company of Sarup Damodar and Ramananda Raya, you know, they would relish this great rasa, wonderful, you know, ecstatic. You know, he would meditate on the ecstasy of these what these verses are saying. So, in this Shishastika, the first verse, there are 7 attributes which describe the glories of the holy name of the Lord. The first one, and by understanding those, by understanding the 7 principal attributes of the holy name, it gives you faith in the holy name. And therefore, this first Shishastika prayer is associated with the level of Shraddha, you know, faith. So, Chaito Dharpana Marjanam, that by chanting Krishna's holy names, Kirtan, you know, chanting the Lord's holy names, Sankirtan, which includes, you know, all different forms of Kirtan, principally the chanting of the holy names, but all different forms of Kirtan as well. But Kirtan, or chanting the names, fame, glory, pastimes, etc. of the Lord properly. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says that Sankirtan does not refer to improper or partial chanting. If chanting the glories of the Lord's name, fame, form, etc. is done improperly or partially, it is not considered Sankirtan. He says, and if that is done, what happens is you do not get the optimum benefit from the holy name, and therefore one can lose faith in the holy name. But Sankirtan, he's saying complete kirtan. It means kirtan that is done properly and fully, not whimsically. That kirtan then has the optimum effect. Now, one of the effects, the first effects, is that it actually cleanses the dust from the mirror of the mind. So our consciousness is covered, and we, you know, because just like a mirror, the consciousness is compared to like a mirror. So if you look at yourself in a mirror, and the mirror is covered in all dirt and dust, so you cannot see a clear picture of yourself. You see some distorted, if it's very, very covered, you can hardly understand, you know, what is in there. Just a few glimpses here and there. It's very, very covered. But when you chant Hare Krishna, it actually cleans all that dust away from the consciousness, and therefore one is able to see the actual self reflected in your pure consciousness, the pure ego of the spirit soul. Seeing the self, just like if you look in the mirror, you see everything else as well. Right? So when you see yourself, you also see how the self is entangled in the three modes of material nature. So, you know, if you're looking, you see, oh, I am a spirit soul in this body composed of the three modes of material nature, you know, being pushed by time like this, and therefore there is so much karma and activity. And, you know, the Supreme Lord is also sitting within my heart. So when you see the self, you don't just see yourself. If you're actually looking properly, just like if you look in a mirror, you see yourself standing in a room, you know, and everything else. Or, you know, if you're outside. When the sun comes up, you don't just see yourself when the sun comes up. You see the sun. You see everything, you know, like that. So cleansing the mirror of the mind means that you see yourself, all the five fundamental principles that are mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. The Supreme Lord, Jiva, karma, time, prakriti. So, when a person sees himself, then they understand what their true religion is. They see, I am the eternal servant of God, of Krishna. And therefore, my eternal religion, my eternal nature, my eternal occupation is to serve God. So as soon as you see yourself, you can also see eternal religious principles. You cannot understand eternal religious principles until you understand the self, spirit soul. And as soon as you see the spirit soul, you can understand eternal religious principles. Therefore, those, you know, different religions or philosophers who see the self as somehow connected to the body, how can they understand eternal religious principles? Because they misunderstand the self, they can never teach eternal religious principles. Eternal religious principles means we are the eternal servant of the Supreme Lord, and as soon as we see ourselves, we can understand that. So that is the first, and then Chaitadapana Marjanam Bhava Mahadvagni. That by understanding the self as the eternal servant of Krishna, it destroys all the anarthas within the heart. So we have so many other desires, and then when we realize, you know, gee, I'm desiring this to be happy, I'm desiring this, but now I just want to be reinstated in my eternal position as a servant of Krishna. So it destroys all those unwanted desires, and by destroying all those unwanted desires, you also destroy the sufferings that go along with all that sort of, you know, that activity, trying to pursue material desires in this material world. That the Shreya Karavachandrika Avataran means that this Sankirtan movement is the benediction moon. The holy name is like the benediction moon. And the rays, the very cooling rays of the benediction moon is the Dini Shakti. So just like certain flowers, they unfurl when the moonlight is there. So when one chants the holy name of the Lord, the spiritual potency, the Ladini Shakti of the holy name, literally that light helps to unfurl the flower, the blossoming flower of Bhava within one's heart, within one's consciousness. So therefore, that produces the most auspicious, you know, the greatest auspicious effect that, you know, that is possible. This, you know, flowering of love of God begins, you know, by the potency of the holy name. Vijyavadu Jivanam, that it's not just a sentiment. You know, Krishna consciousness is not just a sentiment, but the Bhakti Devi, by chanting the holy name of the Lord, Bhakti Devi suffuses the heart with transcendental knowledge. So there is, you know, full knowledge, full transcendental knowledge. Just like here, Balaram is giving transcendental knowledge of what is the Self, what is the Supreme Self, what is their relationship. That is there by chanting the holy name of the Lord. Pariparam pranambitasvaranam. By chanting the holy name, it actually, when the spirit soul, he realizes his constitutional position as a servant of the Lord, and he is then able to re-establish a relationship with Krishna, with the Supreme Lord. Krishna, Supreme Personality of Godhead, or sometimes, one of his different expanded forms, one develops a particular relationship, generally in five principal categories, either neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental, or conjugal relationship. And by establishing a relationship with Krishna, God is unlimited. He's the most ecstatic person you ever want to meet. And you become ecstatic by having that relationship with that supreme ecstatic person. All his qualities are ecstatic and they're unlimited. The relationship is unlimited, it is uninterrupted, so there is nectar at every step. Anandam buddhivaranam pradipananam pranambitasvaranam. An unlimited ocean of nectar at every step. The glories of the holy name. And Sarvatma Snapadam, that the holy name actually completely embalms and bathes the soul in this Krishna Prema, this love of God. By Krishna Prema being completely bathed and embalmed in Krishna Prema, one is completely cured of material existence. There's sometimes we have different embalming lotions to cure us from particular diseases. So there's nothing more powerful than love of God, pure love of God, Krishna Prema, to cure all the diseases associated with material existence, completely finish out material existence itself. And Param Vijayate Shri Krishna Sankirtan, that the holy name of the Lord is ever victorious. So therefore, the holy name of the Lord is completely victorious in establishing the supremacy of the pastimes of Srimati Radharani and Sri Krishna, and establishing that living entity in Krishna Prema, so that they can actually enjoy on that transcendental level, in association with the Lord. Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtan also means that whatever service, whatever devotional service, whatever service to God that we do in this world should be accompanied particularly by the chanting of the holy names. It is particularly important. So, you see that within that Shishastikam, in that very first verse, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given, the seven main attributes of the holy name, and such transcendental knowledge that is there. But you do not find that, elsewhere. If you read Srimad Bhagavatam, the instructions of Balaram, they're very, very clear. In many other places where people search for knowledge of religion or transcendence, you cannot find it. Here, we're getting very... So, within that first verse, you can understand, the nature of the spirit soul, how it is a pure spiritual living entity covered by the material energy and by becoming purified through its relationship with the Supreme Lord and love, that it becomes re-established and stops the process of reincarnation. So it sums up, you know, volumes and volumes of philosophy in one verse. But in other literatures, it is very, very hard to find, you know, even a couple of traces on discussion of reincarnation. If we take the Bible, for instance, there are a couple. Although Christians are actually divided, and always have been, as to, you know, many accept reincarnation as part of Christianity, and many do not. Some say that although it's not mentioned so much in the Bible, especially recently, that it is there in the same way that the Trinity is actually not mentioned in the Bible. There is one tiny little mention by John, which is understood to be a very late interpolation. But otherwise, if you read the Bible from start to finish, you don't find, apart from that one little thing about the Trinity. And yet, it is a foundation pillar of Christianity. So some Christians actually argue that reincarnation is like that. Although it's not, you know, mentioned here, there and everywhere, without it, how can you make sense? Just like Origen. Oregon was one of the principal founding forefathers of Christianity. He was never given sainthood, not because he believed in reincarnation, but because he was castrated. I think he castrated himself. And to be a saint, if you have actually inflicted bodily harm on yourself, you cannot be a saint. But still, so therefore he was. They wanted to, but they couldn't. But Origen, he firmly believed in reincarnation, and he said himself, you know, how can, you know, this resurrection of the body, you know, where you take the body which is obviously dispersed throughout the world and somehow bring it all back together and takes a spiritual nature and goes to heaven? He said, you know, he thought it was absurd. But there are some mentions. There's the mention of in the Old Testament, Malachi, I think. He was a prophet, and about 500 years before the birth of Christ, he predicted that Elijah, or Elias, is another way of saying it, would come again, and later he appeared, and evidently he appeared as John the Baptist, which is about 100 years, I think, before Christ. And then when now that particular instance of, you know, reincarnation shows the belief that Christians, you know, are accepting that there is reincarnation, because he would be born again. That's reincarnation. It's the soul, you know, coming back in a different body. there are about 10 different references to that statement within the New Testament, showing, you know, different stages where disciples or, you know, Jesus himself accepted the principle of reincarnation. At one stage, they asked Jesus, Jesus entered a new this village, and he said, "Who do they say I am?" And the disciples said, "Some say you are, you know, Elias. Some say you are John the Baptist. Some say you are Jeremiah, and some say you are some other prophet." Like that. Anyway, at some stage, Jesus actually said himself that John the Baptist was, Elijah, like that. So he confirmed that, you know. So there are different references. There is also the reference of the blind man, when the disciples come across a blind man, and they said to Jesus, "Is he blind because he was blind from birth?" I think they call that congenitally blind. He's blind from birth. So they ask, "Is he blind because of his sins or his father's sins?" and that. So again, now these are the primary disciples of Jesus. So here, again, you see that the principal disciples of Jesus, they're also accepting, you know, this principle of reincarnation. So there are, you know, various things there, but actually around about 553 AD, in the they actually, Justinian, who was you know, the ruler of Constantinople, he decreed that the philosophy, you know, certain parts dealing with reincarnation, what have you, should be removed because it was not suitable for the general laity, the general masses of Christians. There are certain reasons for that. One is because he felt that if there was reincarnation, that the general people would not take religion very seriously. They would think, well, if I'm just going to reincarnate again, I'll get serious about my spiritual life and another life. So, but, you know, as we know, the Vedas answer that, okay, if you don't get serious now, but you may end up in the body of a dog or a worm. So, you know, but they, you know, were not so expert in the understanding of exactly how transmigration takes place. but, so, other reasons also is that when I was in Waiheke Island and my Guru Maharaj Indrajumnaswamy was there, and I asked him, you know, I said, reincarnation, you know, it is such a wonderful philosophy that just perfectly explains, you know, reincarnation and karma. You know, you can understand why everyone is born in the position they are, why some people suffer, why people enjoy, you know, reincarnation, karma, perfectly explains everything. It's such a perfect philosophy. Why wouldn't anyone accept it? Why would they accept some philosophy that doesn't quite make sense? He said that he has heard that when you're preaching that all beings are spirit souls and reincarnate from one body to another, therefore it precludes that one should not eat meat. And in order to popularize Christianity among many meat-eating nations and what have you, those parts were removed so that it was more favourable like that. Another reason I heard was that generally the rulers considered that they were, you know, they had divinity. Whereas, now, if all living beings were given that divinity, that they, you know, even a dog was spiritual by nature, it sort of gave an equality to everyone, and that wasn't very tasteful for those who put themselves up as the only, you know, divinities. So anyway, for different reasons, and for different political reasons and what have you, you know, certain parts have been known, you know, it is understood now that certain parts have been removed, but still there are some parts there. But it is very, very difficult, you know, if you're reading through certain, you know, religious literatures of the world, if you want to know about reincarnation, if you want to know about the soul, if you want to know about the super soul, the modes of material nature and time, prakriti, you cannot find this information. You know, there is some parts there, it is very difficult. You read Bhagavad Gita and it is just like, you know, there's just so much information that, you know, in one lifetime, if we just read all day, every day and just listened to tapes all day, we just couldn't get through it all. There's so much information, so many analogies, you know, discussed from so many different points of view. This is the wonder of, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, and we're hearing from Balaram, we hear from Krishna. Of course, Balaram is speaking to Rukmini, but it's not that Rukmini is in the bodily conception of life. Krishna actually spoke to Arjun. Krishna arranged that Arjun became a little bewildered so he could speak Bhagavad Gita for our benefit, who are bewildered. You know, we are an illusion. We actually think, you know, we are the body and, you know, God doesn't exist and so many things like that. Arjuna was put into, you know, a temporary state of confusion so that Krishna could speak Bhagavad Gita. In one sense, this pastime, Balaram is also taking advantage of Rukmini's apparent show of fearfulness to also speak transcendental knowledge, you know, for our benefit. But there's another point to Rukmini's fearfulness. Rukmini is actually fearful not because she thinks that Krishna is going to kill her brother. She doesn't care about Rukmini. She cares about all living entities, but she actually has Krishna prema. Her soul, to the exclusion of all others, all her love completely resides in Krishna alone. But her love is a little bit subject to public opinion. That was described in by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in verse 32. Therefore, Rukmini is a little concerned at, you know, what people may say. She certainly doesn't want any slurs being labelled at Krishna because, you know, of the events that unfolded. She would, you know, certainly wouldn't want Krishna to be slandered in any way. There's some, you know, her love is a little bit, there's consideration of public opinion. It's called samanjasa. Whereas the gopis, they also had this exclusive love for Krishna to the exclusion of all other living entities, but it includes all living entities. In other words, if you love Krishna, you automatically love everyone, but you certainly never exclude Krishna for the sake of loving someone else. That's the point. But the gopis, they also have love, but their love is called samartha, which means that they did not care about public opinion or anything. They were prepared to risk everything and anything for the pleasure of Krishna. So, you know, on that platform of conjugal love, there are three different levels. There is Sadarani, which is represented by Kubja. There is Sandarasya, which is represented by the queens of Dwarka, and there's Samartha, represented by the gopis. So the first one is what they call smouldering love. The queen's love is what they call burning, and the gopi's love is blazing. So, you know, you can understand it is all love on this conjugal love of God, but one is smouldering, you know, a small fire is easily disturbed. The queens of Dwarka, their love is very strong, burning fire, but the gopi's love is like a blazing forest fire. You cannot stop. It consumes everything in its path, you know, like that. So, you know, another analogy is that Kubja's love is compared to a precious gem, whereas the queen's, their love is compared to Chintamani, transcendental, you know, gem is saying. Whereas the gopi's love is compared to the Kustuba jewel, the most valuable jewel within all material and spiritual creations. Like that. So, whereas the queens here, Rukmini, there is some conception of the opulence of Krishna, that he is God, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that invokes some sort of fear, awe and reverence. Therefore, she's very, very careful and fearful in one sense as to how she deals with things. It restricts the loving reciprocation to some degree. On the platform of the gopis, the opulence, Aishwarya, the Lord's opulence is covered over by his sweet aspect, sweetness, Madhurya. So, jnana, transcendental knowledge of God, sometimes it, you know, in the very elevated relationships, such as with the gopis and the inhabitants of Vrindavan, it acts as a restricting element. Now, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement is called, you know, the benediction moon. See? Because it reveals everything. Some things are not seen in the sunlight. Gyan, or knowledge, is compared to sunlight. When there's knowledge of God's opulence, you cannot appreciate, taste, or, you know, understand the sweet relationships where they do not consider, you know, Krishna as God. So that knowledge of God's opulence is compared to sunlight. In the sunlight, you cannot see the moon. You know, generally, you cannot see the stars. So in the sunlight, some things cannot be seen. Right? But when at night time, when the moon is there, then you can see the stars, you can see the moon. So some things are only seen in the darkness. So in this sense also, you know, Rukmini, her love is affected by this, you know, just a little, you know, very powerful, strong, transcendental love, of course, but is more restricted than the gopis' love, where they do not consider, you know, the opulence of the Lord is completely covered over by the sweet relationship that they have with him. So Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement, the benediction moon, is actually revealing this sweetness of Braja, which has never ever been revealed before. Previously, in the sunlight of transcendental knowledge of God's opulences, they could never taste. But through the holy name of the Lord, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, through the benediction moon, he's revealing this sweet aspect of, you know, these sweetest intimate relationships, completely unrestricted, that have never ever been revealed before. So this is another aspect of, you know, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's benediction moon. So, and that is an aspect of why Rukmini showed some fear there. So that is Lord Balaram's instructions, and there are more to come. So does anyone have any questions or...